Start voting now for your favorite local music acts with the 21st Annual Houston Press Music Awards ballot. Ballots are available in the weekly issue of the Houston Press and online at houstonpress.com. KPFT has been nominated in three categories. Visit www.kpft.org to check it out and click the link to make your votes. Also check out Matt and Kim, Jonathan Tyler and the Northern Lights, Trey the Truth, and over 60 local nominated bands on the ballot on Saturday, August 7th along the Washington Avenue corridor. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
XXIV is Roman for 24, and you know what they say about that. And what they say is that they will be there at the Last Concert Cafe on Saturday, July 31st for the 24th Annual Watermelon Dance and Summer Social. This KPFT benefit features the Spare Parts Band, Leslie Newman, Jimmy Dean, Los Vertigos, Richard Cagle, Larry from Austin, Plump, The Rafters, The Hightailers, and Pot Roast, all starting at 4 o'clock. Located at 1403 Nan Street, just off the Hardy McKee exit on I-10, the Last Concert Cafe is the ideal place for Houston's premier summertime music festival. The door fee is $15 for one, $25 for two. So bring a friend and come on out and dance a while you support your community radio station, 90.1 KPFT, Houston. XXIV, 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 XXIV.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And just for that, I'm going to cut your mics off. This evening, it's Sonia and Disappear Fear. Music and interviews on J.D. Doyle's award-winning Queer Music Heritage in our second hour. But first, Jimmy Carper, longtime community activist and host of KPFT's After Hours, is here and actually still alive. And then after Jimmy, we have the entire This Way Out with news wrap and audio file leading up to 10 p.m. when you will hear Queer Music Heritage. And so that is our show this evening.
That was great.
Yeah.
That's
perfect.
Yeah. Have you been doing this long?
Something like that.
I'm Jennifer Renee.
I'm not going to divulge my age.
Oh.
50. One.
No, we're all 21 here on the radio, and we're all 10s.
There you go.
That's the best way of doing it, ain't you? You're always a 10. Everyone's
a
10 on the radio.
You're post-op or not.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
This has gone downhill real quickly, but let's try to regain our composure. No,
okay.
Never mind.
So, I'm Brian Levinka.
Yeah, and I'm Jennifer Renee. And we have a very special guest here tonight, one of my favorite people anyway. And I was telling a bit of a story, or started to, that I got my start on the radio on After Hours.
You did.
Yes.
You did.
There was a couch out in the lobby of KPFT, and it was late. I'm not used to staying up that way. And I was asleep out in the lobby, and they came and got me. Said, "It's time, you're on the air."
Yeah.
And I came in, and it was a wonderful experience. I really enjoyed it. And then when I got the opportunity to intern here on Queer Voices, I jumped at the chance.
Well, you are one of the few people who walked into a radio studio and just had a love affair with a microphone. I mean, you weren't scared, or you didn't hold back. You just were you.
Well, and I've tried to stay that way. We have Jimmy Carper here, if you didn't figure that out. And Jimmy is the host of After Hours. How long has After Hours been on?
In September, we celebrate our 23rd birthday.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And I've been with the show. I started with the show when it was 6 months old.
Oh, gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Who actually started it?
Buddy Johnston. In fact, he interned on this show.
Oh, really?
As a matter of fact. Well, it was Waldenstein.
Waldenstein. And an incarnation of the show.
And he got an opportunity to do a late-night talk show. It came on from 2 to 4. That's why he named it After Hours.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it grew to midnight to 4. And
and now it's 1 to 4.
Well, Yes.
Sort of. Technically. I think it's technically scheduled 1 to 4.
We are technically 1 to 4.
But you start.
We're filling in that first hour that's empty right now. Yeah. So
it's midnight to 4.
Midnight to 4 right now.
Which is incredible.
It's. Yeah. But we never have problems filling it.
Well, what's wonderful about this show, if y'all haven't gotten the opportunity to do so, you've got to stay up. If you're driving, going home, turn it on and listen.
Go to kpft.org.
Okay. Well, I was trying to get them listening to you live.
Well, yeah, that's always better.
Yes. And but one of the things that you do is you set aside segments of the program of that 4 hours for different organizations
in
the GLBT community to come on and just talk.
Long ago, I thought, you know, I can talk about transgender issues, but I ain't one. So let's get some transgender people here. Let's get some bisexual people here. Let's get some teens. Let's get some leather people. You know, just whoever wants to do a segment.
Right.
And over the years, it's, you know, we've been heavy in this and they're light in that. But they kind of come and go. But well, I never have a problem getting segments.
Well, there's always somebody out there in our community willing to talk.
Yes, yes.
Especially when they're talking about themselves. Have you ever found that? All you do is say, well, tell me about yourself. And then all you do is sit back and drink a cup of coffee,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Those are some of my favorite interviews.
So, Jimmy, how did you get started in radio?
A friend of mine called me up and said, I found this really strange show on the radio. What it was is that he started dating a guy who worked on the show.
Okay.
But I found this great show. You might be interested. And so I listened the next week. And the week after that, I showed up at the door and said I want to do anything from answering the phone to whatever it is you want me to do. And And here I am.
Now, that was after hours.
That was after hours.
Wait,
yes.
Some people don't realize that, you know, we're volunteers down here.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, you volunteer intern.
Yes.
If you like radio, you like a favorite show, see about interning or volunteering on that show.
Well,
answer the telephones. Do something.
Exactly. I was a member of the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard at the time. And
I remember that.
The show was having problems because people were calling in with coming out calls. And problem calls and even a suicide call.
Right.
And so that was what I did for the first 6 months. I was just on the phone until I got some other volunteers from the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard.
You recruited people so you could get off the phone.
So I could get on the air.
Okay.
And of course, for many years, I was Mary.
Right.
To Buddy. And I didn't do much more than say yes, or I don't think so. Or Buddy liked to do monologues.
Oh, yeah. I'm familiar with. Yeah. There's some people I know that like that too.
And when he left the show in 1991, I took over, and I don't like to do monologues, and I kind of changed the format and. It has evolved over the years into what it is today.
Well, I remember Sarah DePalma.
Oh, absolutely.
Was your sidekick that night I came on.
Yes.
And Sarah and I became fast friends. And then I forgot when it was, right after I came on Queer Voices as a co-host, I got one of those phone calls to do an interview. I've never done an interview, you know, from someplace in Boston. She and I were really the only transgender, actively transgender hosts in America.
Yes.
And I was going, wow.
Yes, yes.
What did you talk about on that first segment?
We talked about how we got on the show and about how much we really enjoyed, you know, giving a voice to the transgender community. You know, and that's where I got my joke about, or not my joke, I'm serious about, the T is no longer silent.
That's right.
You know, the transgender community has a voice.
Sarah started, she was a guest. She had been asked by someone else to be a guest.
Okay.
Who was doing the segment, and that person didn't show up.
What the hell? Okay.
So I thought, okay.
Well, we've had a few nights like that when people haven't shown.
Okay, I'm going to interview this transgendered lady. Okay. And so I sat her down, and the first thing I asked her was, gee, you don't look like a man in a dress.
Oh, Lord. That's a good start.
That's how much I knew about the transgender community.
Oh.
So over the years, I was educated.
Well, unfortunately, there's still a number of people still think that.
Sure.
Well, it's hard to relate because you kind of relate to what you know. And as gay men,
you know,
men liking men, it's hard to imagine being born in the wrong body and feeling like you're the wrong gender. And as you get to know someone that's transgendered, you realize that and you kind of identify with that. And that's how we kind of grow together as a community.
But you know, when you think about it, as gay men even, we were different. A lot of us had more feminine sides to us that we showed. We crossed the gender line. That was our problem. And so I don't think we're very, I don't think we're very far away from transgender people.
I like to, you know, when I'm in conversation, you know, I ask the question, how many gay men understand lesbians? You know, there are not too many people going to raise their hand. And lesbians, how many of you understand that? And so you wonder why you don't understand transgender people? The truth is that all of us are a little bit transgender. Because
we cross that line. That gender line, yes.
Yes, we do. We all do, yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes, you look cute in a dress.
Oh. but you know, you're talking about how do gay men and lesbians know each other. And the answer is before AIDS, we didn't. Very few of us knew lesbians, and very few lesbians knew gay men, but lesbians were the ones in the forefront to help people with AIDS.
Right.
To get through it.
That's something a lot of people don't understand.
That's right. And that kind of broke the barrier. Now, I think most gay men have a lesbian friend or two or more.
Well, I mean, it's important that we have that community, and part of it, it's very tragic what happened in the AIDS epidemic.
But it made us a closer community.
Made us a community,
mm-hmm.
where in the fact we were all our individuals going every which directions, and the gay men, and you had lesbian women, and the trans people, and was no GLBT.
No, there wasn't. And I think of my life kind of as kind of separate lives, because in my early years, I was one of those corporate queens who, you know, I took from the gay community on weekends, didn't give back, and kind of, if somebody worked in a gay business, you looked down on them, because that's all they could do.
Oh.
That's all they could get. And, you know, that kind of thing. But I grew, and the AIDS, especially during the AIDS epidemic, that's when I got involved with the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard and ACT UP and everything else in my life. Got involved in radio and became, you know, I don't know, Mr. Queer Montrose, whatever. A professional gay, I guess, is what you would call it. And yeah. So I did that for a long time, and now I find I'm in a new life. Maybe your audience doesn't know, but my lover of 32 years passed away a couple of months ago.
Yes.
So now I think about it, and that I had been a couple for more than half my life, and now I'm entering a new phase.
Absolutely.
Of widowhood and all that goes with that.
Well, just want to remind everybody, we're talking with Jimmy Carper, host of After Hours here on KPFT. Saturday night after midnight?
Saturday night at midnight.
Okay.
But technically,
it's Sunday morning
1 to 4.
When I was out there hitting the clubs, I don't do that much anymore, but when I was doing that, it was still Saturday night when it was 3 in the morning.
Oh, absolutely. It's still Saturday night.
The sun hadn't come up yet, so it's still Saturday night.
So just tune us in on your way home, and you never know what you may hear. We have a lot of freedom.
Now, there's a rumor that I heard I've got to find out. It's one of those many questions I've had over the years. Did y'all really do a show nude?
Yes.
You did.
Yes.
Well, see, I told you we're doing nude radio here at KPFT. Well,
I can vouch for that.
I need to go to my gym.
I thought that was one of those urban myths that had been spread.
No, that's okay, Jennifer. Go to your happy place. Go to your happy place.
Well, I'll tell you how it transpired.
I want to hear.
I wasn't even there that night. I was out of town.
Oh.
We had the Lone Star Nudists on.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
And so they congregated right here in this talk studio, and anybody who wanted to be in on the interview
had to be
nude. And so we blocked the door, and they held that interview.
When was that? Do you have any idea when that was? I mean, this has been
it's been a while back.
It's been a story that I've heard for years.
Yes.
It's probably not these chairs, right?
No.
No. These are new chairs.
Okay. They were.
Newer chairs. I hope.
We hope. Oh, I don't know.
Well, you know, we do things like that. I mean, we've done, we have a leather segment, and we've done all kinds of demonstrations, fire demonstrations and toy demonstrations, and we do that on the air and explain what's happening.
Well, you have that rare opportunity between midnight
and
4.
Yeah. We
that a that. Lot of the restrictions that, like this show has,
exactly.
don't have.
When we do something on Safer Sex, we can use the street language that kids out there will understand.
Well, that's good. I mean,
yeah.
they got to understand.
Yeah.
So, what are some of the more unusual things? I mean, other than being nude on the radio.
I remember.
Was everybody a 10? I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, absolutely not. And you find it was all ages and sizes. And you know, you find that if you're a gay man, you find beauty in a man's body at any age.
Right.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the more unusual things was we had a transgender activist, Don, who went step by step explaining her sexual reassignment surgery, everything that happened. She had written a diary, and it took almost the whole show to go through step by step from the time she left Houston to from the time she got back and after that.
That would be interesting.
It was fascinating.
Yeah. Is it still in the archives?
Yes, it is.
What date?
Well, not the KPFD archives, but the GCAM archives.
GCAM archives.
Gulf Coast Archive and Museum of Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender History, Inc.
Of which you are a founding member, is that correct?
That's right. How did you know that?
Well, we did our research on you.
Now, who's
we
been...
We did come prepared.
Yes. Who has been your hardest interview?
Oh, gosh. I will not mention the name, but because Houston resident. But it was one of those people that you asked a question and they gave a very short answer and then just sat there looking at you.
Oh, those are hard. We've had a few of those. Like, yes.
Happens is, you know, when you have one or two of those, actually, you know, in my 4 years mm-hmm. here, you know, what you do is you prepare better.
Yes.
So you can interview yourself.
Which we're good at.
We're good at.
You find yourself trying to ask questions that need more than just the yes or no.
Yes, exactly. Retooling that.
Ooh, that was tough. And in my very, very early years, I had the first year I was here, I had the opportunity to interview Armistead Maupin.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
who
gosh.
Came to the studio with his boyfriend. It was one of those things, I felt so insignificant doing this. It was like, you know, I am not worthy. And I was just... Fortunately, two of us were doing the interview, so she was the same way as me. But you know, where I faltered, she picked up on it, and we got through it okay. But fortunately, Armistead likes to talk.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right.
So that helped.
In 23 years, mm-hmm. almost,
What's the most emotional evening show? What was the story that really touched your heart the most?
Wow, there's been so many.
I think I can answer that one for you, because I was here when it happened.
Yeah.
What was the guy's name with the dark hair? A little bit heavy set. What was his name? He came on and he talked about, he was sitting out in the lobby, mm-hmm. and the subject of treatment, anti-gay treatment and electroshock therapy came up.
Yes.
And he walked into the studio and told the story
yes.
of his own electroshock treatment.
We were all in tears.
Was radio.
That, yeah.
Wow.
That is, and it's things like that that I make me believe in live radio.
Big Roy.
Big, yeah.
Yeah.
We've had the opportunity to have tape segments from people in the community, and we turn them down because there's nothing like live radio. You never know what's going to happen.
It's spontaneous.
Yes. Yes.
You enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
By the way,
and we get that kind of...
No. By the way, we're talking with Jimmy Carver here, host of After Hours here on KPFT on midnight on Saturday night till 4 in the morning Sunday morning.
Now, I was the host and sole producer for a very long time.
But you're not anymore. You've got
not
help
anymore.
Now.
Yes. Chris Harrison has been my co-producer for quite a few years now. And recently, we got Wes Laverne. Who had been the intern on one of the engineers. And so we're a threesome now. So which means I can go out of town and not have to worry. You know,
you don't have to worry about Saturday night.
Yes.
You can have a social life.
It used to be I did the engineering, the hosting, the talking. I never left the chair for 4 hours.
Yeah, that's...
Which can be awfully uncomfortable.
Oh, my God.
But and you can't travel out of town on the weekends.
No. I could never go unless I got another programmer from another show come and babysit.
And see, that's dedication to radio there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, Jimmy, do you remember back when we used to have Q Patrol and we would call in?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
yes. I remember Q Patrol.
Yes, we would call in from Patrol and you would put us on the air.
Mm-hmm. I
remember when they came in to the show.
Oh, yes.
Yes, came by to visit.
Yes.
Q Patrol's here.
Maybe we need to explain what Q Patrol is.
Yes.
Yes, please. Go right
Jimmy,
ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well,
you were involved.
That's right.
Would you tell us about Patrol?
Q Patrol, yeah. Not to be confused with Pet Patrol.
Right.
But Q Patrol was started in response to some violence in the Montrose against the gay community.
Paul Broussard.
Yes.
Paul Broussard.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the fact that at the time, HPD seemed somewhat insensitive.
Reticent would be a word. Good word.
And I think it was Queer Nation who formed like a splinter group.
That's exactly right.
And they were doing this sort of Q Patrol type thing. And then along came Connie and I, mm-hmm. and we turned the thing into a 501c3 corporation.
Yeah.
And then we got funding, a lot of fundraising, and we got better radios than the police had at the time.
And what did Q Patrol do?
Patrolled the bar area.
Yeah, that's right. We patrolled the Montrose area and also around Venture. And
mm-hmm. That's right.
We could go all around with these good radios that we had. And it was mainly just being a visible presence, because we had the magnetic signs on the cars.
Oh, and you had the pink nasty grams too.
That's right. We had the kind of sort of equivalent of a ticket,
uh-huh.
which was if we saw a vehicle, especially if they were acting up, you know, doing something like. Well, anyway,
like
we calling names,
like full of teenagers,
yes,
and shouting, at
looking for
out.
Trouble, right. Epithets. Yes.
Then we had a connection where we could trace the license plate number, and we would send to that address of who owned the vehicle. We would send them a postcard in the mail, and it was pink, and it said, you know, greetings from Q Patrol, and etc. Your vehicle was spotted at this time in this place with this going on, whatever. You know, please be aware that it's against the law to blah, blah, blah. But if you or your son or daughter has a genuine interest in the gay or lesbian lifestyle, please feel free to contact
the
gay lesbian switchboard.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
How many did you send out?
I think we probably sent out 10 or 20. And I can tell you, we tracked vehicles by license plate number. I wrote a database. And we never saw one of those vehicles again that we sent a pink ticket out on.
I bet you didn't. Oh, my God.
Now, did you hand out violations for fashion?
We did that, too.
Yes, we did.
As a fundraising stunt.
Yes.
As a fundraising stunt, we came up with the idea of doing the same thing. I think it was a different colored card. Mm-hmm. But we would go up to people who were dressed a little too flamboyantly, and we would say, here's your fashion citation. Some of them were genuinely annoyed. But we would explain to them, you know, that this is actually a fundraising stunt for Q Patrol, and so, you know, please take it in the genuine.
Yeah,
but they spent all those hours getting ready to go out, and here you come.
Yeah, no. Wait a second. That would have been hurt. I probably was.
Some people were hurt that they didn't get fashion.
That's right. We tried. So, all of these things that have come out of After Hours, you 23 years on the air, you've had lots of opportunities.
There's been hundreds of people who have been involved in this radio show, because I've always had a crew of people who hang out and then come on for right now we have Roundtable from 3 to 4.
Right.
And it's everybody, it's the whole crew, who's ever left at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Whoever wants to come on.
And you have people from, you know, teenagers to me.
Yeah.
And I'm 62 years old. So, you know, you get a variety of opinions and ideas about a gay subject.
And that's that's the best radio, when you get a mixing of opinions.
It is.
And that's spontaneous radio, and it's live, and that you can't get it anywhere
sometimes
else.
I feel like such a dinosaur. Because the younger crowd has such a different idea about what it means to be gay than I did growing up.
But they're the hope.
Yes.
They're the hope of our community, another generation.
Yes.
I mean, the ones coming up now that can't vote yet, being gay, being trans, being lesbian, are just ho-hum. Mm-hmm.
And they don't live in the shadow of AIDS as much.
That's right.
I mean, it's kind of,
and that can be a problem.
Well, I think it's
a danger with some
in the way that it united our community, as it's becoming less and less visible and more people are becoming more apathetic. It's becoming less cohesive, and I think it's a very lingering danger out there for our younger
community. We're finding more and more teenagers and 20-somethings seroconverting. And
yeah.
It drives me crazy.
It's like we've forgotten the history of the 80s and the 90s.
I remember one group that I talked to about this. I'm not going to mention the group. But what I did, they were kind of apathetic about AIDS. I stripped and showed them my body and told them, now this is what happens to you with AIDS.
Oh, my God.
You know, the protease belly.
Yes,
I've got the little cysts showing up, and I've got, you know, the stuff on the arm, the thin skin with the easy hematomas and the wasting, the skinny legs, skinny arms. Yes.
How did it affect
them? And face.
How did it affect them?
Well, they were shocked that I would do it in the first place. And
well, they didn't yet know you, obviously.
And I think I may have changed a couple of minds.
You got to hit
that's
home.
Good. Yeah.
Connect with them.
All right. You've been on 23 years.
Yes.
What's the
future?
What's the future?
More of it.
More of it.
You know, when we first started the show, it was all about coming out.
Right.
And after 23 years...
Everybody's out.
You know, so where do we go from here? But there's still people in Needville and all these little towns who still think, even though they've got internet connections, they can listen to us, and it's a live voice. Because we bring 4 hours of queer life We all talk about our lives and what it means to be gay and what we've done that week and what we're going to do. I want people to know what it's like to be a queer.
Yeah, for your show, like our show, it's the only connection some people get. You know, somewhere tonight, we know that there are kids somewhere secretively listening to the program.
Absolutely.
Just to have that kind of contact. Because I mean, there's only after hours in us here in Houston.
That's it. And we're lucky, and we're lucky.
We've got two.
None of the other Pacifica stations has this much queer airtime.
Are there any other regular shows on the other Pacifica stations that are strictly GLBT?
There are.
I'm not going to ask you to tell them,
But they're like half-hour shows.
Basically 6 hours of GLBT life and news every week on KPFT.
Yeah, you're the 60 minutes of queer radio, and we're...
And what are you?
We're Colbert.
Exactly.
The Colbert Report. Well, we've been listening to Jimmy Carper, who is a host, along with a bevy of other people, co-hosting After Hours here on KPFT, Saturday after midnight till 4 in the morning.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I've enjoyed, you know, you gave me my start, and here I am, and I owe it to you.
I know. Look at you today.
Look
great.
At this. And thank you. This is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Hey, Bug. Don't be back late.
I know.
Come give us a hug before you go.
Hug her. That's what she's there for.
Each of my moms had a kid with your son.
Cool. I love lesbians.
Great.
Looks like the freedom. Looks like the freedom train.
Wanna get married, we should get married, people get married all the time.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Sexual oppression compounds the international AIDS crisis. Lesbian moms, their sperm men, and the kids are all right. And three queer crooners sing out in the audiophile. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Ben Caron.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 24th, 2010. The 18th Biennial International AIDS Conference wrapped up in Vienna on July 23rd. About 20,000 scientists, healthcare professionals, and people living with AIDS met during the week to review the latest discoveries about the global pandemic, how best to fight it, and what needs to be done to improve those efforts. A study released at a pre-conference event by Johns Hopkins University and the World Bank warned that countries already ravaged by the disease need to do more to eliminate their legal and societal oppression of men who have sex with men. The report noted a dangerous surge of HIV infections in several countries in Africa that criminalize gay and bisexual men. HIV/AIDS agencies in some of those countries don't even specifically track infections among men who have sex with men.
The United Nations Development Program and the Asia-Pacific Coalition on Male Sexual Health presented a study at the conference that also linked criminalizing gay sex to increased infection rates. The report noted that same-gender sex is outlawed in 19 countries in Asia and warned that HIV is spreading among men who have sex with men in those countries at alarming rates. It said more than 90% of gay men in the Asia-Pacific region have no access to prevention and care. Those studies enforce what LGBT activists and AIDS researchers have long believed, that homophobia in any country fuels increased HIV infections. The next International AIDS Conference will be held in 2012 in Washington, D.C.
Gay men in most countries in the Middle East also face criminal prosecution and repression. We told you several weeks ago about a series of raids on private parties for gay men in Syria. The GayMiddleEast.com website reported this week that more than 25 men arrested during those raids in March and April have been released without trial. Private consensual adult gay sex is punishable under the Syrian Penal Code by up to 3 years in prison. The website speculated that the men were released after months of detention without facing formal charges because Syrian officials were embarrassed by the international media attention the raids had received.
But the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC, was granted consultative status this week by the United Nations Economic and Social Council. The U.S.-based queer rights organization has been lobbying for accreditation since 2007. The vote by the full council, 23-13 with 13 abstentions, overrode a council committee led by Egypt, Russia, and China that last month recommended that IGLHRC's application be rejected. Western diplomats said at the time that they'd lobby the full council to reverse the committee's decision. Among the nations who joined Egypt, Russia, and China in the full council's no vote were Niger, Morocco, Malaysia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. Brazil, Britain, Canada, Germany, Japan, and the U.S. were among those voting in favor. IGLHRC can now attend meetings, submit statements, and collaborate with others at the world body as a recognized non-governmental organization. The group's executive director, Carrie Allen Johnson, called the council vote an affirmation that the voices of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people have a place at the United Nations. According to the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association, best known by the acronym ILGA, IGLHRC becomes the eighth LGBT advocacy group to be recognized by the UN Economic and Social Council. It joins the European region of ILGA and national organizations from Brazil, Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the U.S. military policy that bans service by open gays and lesbians, continued to be in the news this week. There's been much criticism of a survey the Pentagon distributed to some 400,000 active duty and reserve troops earlier this month, asking enlisted personnel about serving in a war zone with gays and lesbians, including questions about sharing barracks and showers with them. Activist and blogger John Aravosis added fuel to the fire over the value of the survey this week, reporting that he'd gained easy access to it online under fake service member identities, and actually responded to the survey three different times. Conventional wisdom that no similar poll had ever been done leading up to a major military personnel policy change was also disputed this week by research that turned up highly prejudiced responses in different surveys in the 1940s that asked white and Christian troops about serving with Jews and African Americans. Black Americans served at that time in completely segregated units. Despite data that confirmed overwhelming intolerance, President Harry Truman issued an executive order in 1948 that integrated the U.S. military. LGBT activists have questioned why self-titled fierce advocate for queer rights President Barack Obama hasn't followed in Truman's footsteps by at least ordering a stop to investigations and discharges under the policy until its anticipated congressional repeal sometime next year.
Lawyers for the Log Cabin Republicans asked a federal judge this week to issue an injunction to do just that. Lawyer Dan Woods made the request of U.S. District Court Judge Virginia A. Phillips during closing arguments on July 23rd, capping the two-week federal trial in Riverside, California, challenging the constitutionality of the policy. Some observers believe that she may delay issuing a ruling until after Congress decides whether or not to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
And Lieutenant Dan Choi, the Arabic linguist and Iraq War veteran who initiated what became an inevitable process by coming out on MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show last year, revealed publicly this week that he had been notified of his honorable discharge under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. His parents apparently received the discharge letter at their Tustin, California home on June 29th, but Choi said he hadn't spoken with them since his last visit there in June of last year. He said his commander in the New York Army National Guard, where he'd continued to serve without any problem since coming out, gave him the news by phone this week. Choi, who said he had hoped to become America's first Korean-American general when he entered West Point, told his hometown newspaper, the Orange County Register, that you never can prepare for the moment when they say your whole military career is over, you feel like your insides are going into knots. But he vowed to continue his LGBT activism, Real honor and dignity are doing what the military uniform stands for, he said, and that's fighting for freedom and justice.
The now civilian Dan Choi was among eight activists arrested during a demonstration in Las Vegas on July 20th. The protests, sponsored by the direct action group Get Equal, chastised Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada for his perceived inaction on ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Get Equal co-chair Robin McGahee was also among those arrested in the civil disobedience action that stopped traffic on the Las Vegas Strip at the New York, New York Hotel's Statue of Liberty. The group stretched a large banner across the street that read, "Read, no one can do more, getequal.org." Congressional Democrats have repeatedly assured LGBT advocacy groups that the federal legislation to ban workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity would come up for a vote during this session. But The Hill, the U.S. Capitol's insider newspaper, reported in mid-July that Senate leadership doesn't want to address the potentially hot-button issue prior to the August recess, after which the November midterm elections loom, even though polling shows considerable public support for the measure. It's perfectly legal to be fired for nothing more than being gay or lesbian in 29 U.S. states, and to be fired for your gender identity or expression in 38 states.
Elsewhere, Irish President Mary McAleese signed the country's Civil Partnerships Bill into law on July 19th, about a week after it was approved in the country's upper legislative chamber. The legislation gives gay and lesbian couples many of the rights of heterosexual marriage. LGBT advocacy groups have praised the progress, but say the measure fails to recognize and support children whose parents are gay or lesbian. New tax and social welfare regulations reportedly need to be established by the government's departments of finance and social protection, so lesbian and gay couples won't be able to contract civil partnerships until January.
Argentina's president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, signed that country's marriage equality bill into law on July 21st. It passed legislative muster on July 15th. Her signature makes Argentina the first Latin American country to open civil marriage to same-gender couples and includes adoption rights. The first ceremony, at which a longtime gay couple will reportedly tie the knot, is expected to take place on August 13th in Buenos Aires.
And finally, Constance McMillan, the Mississippi teenager who sued her school district after it told her she couldn't bring her girlfriend to the senior prom, settled her lawsuit this week for $35,000. The Itawamba County School District also agreed to pay the fees for her American Civil Liberties Union attorneys. The school district additionally promised in the settlement to establish policies against discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in all of its educational and extracurricular activities. Officials at Itawamba Agricultural High School had first canceled the prom entirely, making McMillan a pariah on campus. Her attorney said that she was eventually sent to a decoy, sparsely attended prom, while all her classmates partied at another location. She eventually transferred to a different school in Jackson, Mississippi, and graduated last month. McMillan has been in the national media spotlight for months and served as one of the grand marshals at this year's annual LGBT Pride Parade in New York City. "I won't ever get my prom back," she said in a statement about the long process, "but I hope this means that in the future, students at my school will be treated fairly."
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 24th, 2010. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Ben Caron.
The redemption of a black crow brings out the pink in the gray later in this half hour. In a year rife with shoot-em-ups and family-oriented entertainment, a unique film about an alternative family is performing quite well in limited U.S. release. This Way Out correspondent Linda Birch introduces us to what may prove to be, in the words of one film insider, the lesbian Brokeback Mountain.
Hey, Bug. Don't be back late.
I know.
Come give us a hug before you go.
Hugs.
Hug her. That's what she's there for.
Have you thought any more about making that call?
That could really hurt Mom's feelings.
How can you not even be curious about it?
Each of my moms had a kid with your sperm.
Liking both of them.
Uh-huh, liking gay.
Right on.
Cool, I love lesbians.
Great. And with that setup, The Kids Are All Right takes off as a delightful comedy drama which tells the tale of a perfect family with Annette Bening and Julianne Moore portraying two moms in a long-time marriage raising their two children conceived by artificial insemination. Everything is all right until the children reach out to bring their birth father, played by Mark Ruffalo, into their life and the bonds of family are challenged and redefined.
I get it. He's their biological father and all that crap. Like, we're not enough or something?
I never thought they'd use my stuff.
Why not? Well, I'm using
Donor Dad, Stone Cold Fox. Is he single?
First of all, you.
I met him, and that's cool. And now we can move on.
I want to see him again.
You do?
You do?
So great to meet you.
Go easy on the wine, hon. Stay tight.
Okay. Same goes for the micromanaging.
Well, it's to me. I was a resident, and
Jules had an emergency.
My tongue was numb,
and I told her to relax,
and then
my tongue started working again.
Oh, my God.
The plan was to limit his involvement.
You're not going to stick that, bro.
He's not a father. He's our sperm donor.
I just keep seeing my kid's expressions in your face.
Really?
Really?
I feel like he's taking over my family.
We were really interested in making this a comedy drama, so I felt like, you know, sex is a hard thing to show in a film. You know, where's the boundaries that make it interesting but not, like, oppressive and salacious or whatever?
The Kids Are All Right is director Lisa Cholodenko's biggest commercial film to date. Known for her charged, erotic films, High Art, and Laurel Canyon, Lisa brings a little of that into her work on this comedy drama.
And I just felt like this is the place where, you know, we go for the comedy, where the camera's back here, and it's just like you're just looking at it going like, oh, God, you know, people are so, like, bizarre and sloppy, and everybody's just, you know, you don't see other people having sex, so there's something kind of funny about it, and we wanted to pull that out. You know, it was important not to be, again, to use that word, like, precious about that. At the beginning of the film, you know, it was very personal. I was just in an apartment, and, you know, my partner and I were trying to figure out how to have a family, and we, anonymous sperm donor, and all that stuff, and you start, you know, looking into those subjects, and they become big subjects, and very consuming, and very weighty, and when I put my fingers to the keyboard, like, these ideas, this family just sort of emerged, and this kind of theme sort of emerged, and, you know, not long after that, I ran into Stuart Blumberg in a coffee shop near my house, and started talking to him about this idea that I was working on, and this script I'd started, and he opened up about having been a sperm donor in college, and then I just, oh, okay, you know, you're a straight guy, you live in New York, I'm a gay, I live in L.A. with my girlfriend, you know, I come from a more of a, you know, rarefied world of filmmaking, you come from a personal, let's put this together, and I think if we find some synthesis of things, that's great, that's special.
Synthesis is the right word to describe The Kids Are All Right because it does compare and contrast opposites. It explores first attractions and mature love, bachelorhood and married life, straight and gay sexuality, individuality and family units. The result is a powerful concoction as the character played by Mark Ruffalo disrupts the natural balance of this family.
Driving home on a motorcycle. This is something I just never allowed.
Mom, I'm 18 years old. I just felt so far away from you lately.
Why'd you donate sperm?
It seemed like a lot more fun than donating blood. Hey, I'm glad I did it.
Marriage is hard. Two people, year after year. Sometimes you stop seeing the other person.
Unconventional family.
There's something sort of funny about these two gay moms. One of, and it was, there were more in earlier drafts who had a fear that their son would be gay, because then, like, other people would say, oh, look, they turned him. You know, so, like, not that they would not accept him, but it's like they kind of just wanted, like, please just let him be straight.
The film's co-writer, Stuart Blumberg.
And so, like, this thing with Clay, which is really not gay, it's just, you know, just like two boys are always wrestling, boys are always doing this, but they're projecting all of this stuff onto Laser and Clay, which is kind of hysterical. And then there's this other piece just talking with Lisa and Wendy once, and they just sort of let drop about, you know, occasionally, you know, there might be some gay male porn involved. And I was like, okay, let's just stop right there, because I thought I knew a thing or two. And I was like, explain that to me. And they could, and then I said, all right, so I will say, we need to have that in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, that is something that most people do not know. And it was like, how can we have the kids sort of find that out and have that be a way to tie in, you know, them finding out that they've been meeting Paul and all that stuff. And I basically, because I couldn't speak to the truth of that, I literally sat Lisa down and was like, we're going to talk about why you watch, you know, and we're going to, and that we're going to give that in a really halting, stumbling, awkward way to the moms.
If you're tired of computer-generated graphic animation or movies that are all explosions, then The Kids Are All Right may be just the film to enjoy. For more information, go to filminfocus.com or join The Kids Are All Right Facebook page. I'm Linda Birch.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson. I play Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Three queer musicians are upbeat, introspective, and back on their feet in this month's audiophile.
One, two, three, four. Twisting like a melody and spinning like a top. Little fly, fly, honeybee, I'll be under the apple tree. Oh, fly, fly, honeybee. I'll see you on Sunday afternoon. I'll see you on Sunday afternoon. I'll see you on Sunday afternoon.
Nomalee Brennett is a prolific artist, releasing 8 CDs since her debut in 2002. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and you're listening to Audiophile. Black Crow is the name of Nomalee's latest CD.
Black Crow is a CD that I started working on last year in August, and it was written and recorded based of about 2 or 3 months, and it's a really kind of happy, upbeat collection of songs, also really intimate. Just a great collection of songs that I really enjoyed writing and recording. Really looking forward to taking it on the road.
You can find out about the CD Black Crow at www.nomaleebrennett.com. That's www.nomaleebrennett.com.
The new CD by Toronto artist Kevin Wong is called The Pink in the Gray.
Baby's gonna leave again in another midnight. Another broken game of chance. No, I never planned it. It's like you're saying that's the point to disappoint me. If that's the point, he's made it well as far as I see. So I wear a mask of endless laughter. You laugh but never cry. but I think I'm breaking faster. Break as I wonder why. Same old story, boilers, boys, I trifle with the third as well. You know this tale, yeah, love's no glory when you treat it like a prisoner.
And as you might figure out, the title, The Pink and the Gray, is about the juxtaposition of his gay life into the straight world.
The Pink and the Gray is my second independent release. It's entirely self-written except for one song, which is a Billy Joel cover, entirely self-produced for the first time. And I feel like it's the first musical work that really speaks to what I'm about musically, as well as what my experiences have been with gay dating, love, and loss.
And don't you tell me I've got to rise up. Each time I reach the clouds, well, it's thunder and rain. I'm up in my life without a care to colors apply. But when the air went out of me, what else was left for me to do but sink back down through the night?
Find out more about The Pink and the Gray, the latest album by Kevin Wong, at www.kevinwongmusic.com.
Well, it's kind of a collection of songs that my partner and I started working on when we moved here to Nashville. It's a mixture of kind of modern, almost like Radiohead type music, meets kind of a more like a vintage Pink Floyd, even Marvin Gaye type of feel. And it's really just about kind of getting back on your feet after you've fallen apart.
The whole world could fall apart. I wouldn't mind if I was left with this. Could fade away. I wouldn't care if I had your promise.
The latest album by Daniel J. Cartier is called Redemption, and it's a moving, emotional, and very personal experience with a definite statement about gay marriage.
Truth, the thought of living in silence with love that dare not speak its name. How gonna scream your name out in the sunlight to the world now? 'Cause I feel no shame. I wanna get married, we should get married, people get married all the time. I wanna get married, we should get married, people get married every day.
You can learn more about the album Redemption at www.danieljcartier.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. Find out more about Audiophile or contact us by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Keep listening.
Someday.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Ben Karen, Linda Birch, and J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Thanks also to Steve Pride. Nominally Brennett, Kevin Wong, and Daniel J. Cartier performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This layout is made possible by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and by you. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, listen to our podcasts, read the texts of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. You can also find us on iTunes. Read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com. Follow us on Twitter at TWO Radio, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/ThisWayOutRadio. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WRUW Cleveland, Ohio, CITR Vancouver, British Columbia, Free Radio Santa Cruz, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody, stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
That's Sonia in Disappear Fear, singing about the biggest, baddest heart. That's from their new album, Blood, Bones, and Baltimore, and I just love that album, and I love that artist. This is J.D. Doyle with Queer Music Heritage, and I think Sonia Rutstein has contributed a lot to our music heritage. This month, I'm going to let her tell you her story, and since I'm so thorough, this is another two-part show. Part 1 will cover the new CD and then the history and some of the music of the band Disappear Fear. And Part 2, found on my website, will pick up around 1998 when Sonia started releasing solo recordings, billed as Sonia of Disappear Fear. Before we get to the new album, I'll give a quick intro and say that Disappear Fear was primarily Sonia and her sister Cindy Frank, and they toured together the first 10 years until Cindy opted to devote her time to motherhood. She has, over the years, continued to contribute to the studio recordings. This is also a good time to mention that Sonia and Disappear Fear is one of the most honored acts in our community. During the time the GLAMA Awards, the Gay and Lesbian American Music Awards, were in existence, Sonia and or Disappear Fear were nominated for 9 awards, winning 3. Only Michael Callan, Katie Curtis, and the Indigo Girls received as many nominations and wins, and Sonia was nominated for 3 Out Music Awards, winning 1. But on to Sonia to talk about the new release, their 13th CD, Blood, Bones, and Baltimore.
The new CD is the most organic studio CD we've ever released. We recorded 80% of it in one day. We got going about 10:30 in the morning, and about 11 or so that night I drove home with what was eight songs of what you're hearing now on the radio. It was thrilling, and it's blues, it's Americana, it's kind of the most rootsy CD I've ever made, so that's why I'm calling it organic, and kind of wanted to get a great sense of everybody's participation with it, not just my own.
What was the inspiration for the new album?
I don't know. I mean, I love the blues. It's something that's grown more with me lately. You know, it's really just challenging myself in different directions, and the blues are really a genre that work in any medium. That is, I'm traveling and performing in countries, touring in countries that where English is not the first language, and yet the blues give people a sense of, you know, I get an immediate sense of connection in the room. And, you know, and that's why I'm there. So it's cool. It's cool. I love the way they transcend the, it transcends the languages.
To a lot of people, this will be a little different sound for you. What's the reaction been?
It's been great. It's been really good. Like, whoa, you know, it's been very, very positive. It's still so new. So it's hard to, you know, gauge what, you know, in a year from now or 2 years from now, I'll have a much better picture of how well it's going to fly. But so far, it's doing really good. Very positive responses.
Is there a song that so far seems to be getting the most attention?
Really, two. One of the songs I would say is Paca Newport for the blues part. Another song that's completely different, really, from the blues genre. It's really more of a singer-songwriter ballad, and that's the song Who I Am. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on that one. But that's a much more what I would consider, if there was a standard Sonia song or Disappear Fear song, that's really more of the constant vein of my writing.
I think my favorite is Paca Newport. Could you talk about that?
Oh, cool. they're different sort of things that fed into that becoming a song. One was that I was a smoker in my early 20s. And that was my brand that I smoked, and quitting was really not easy at all. I smoked, I guess, between one and two packs a day. But singing and smoking for me really wasn't an option, so I had to quit. And so I did, and what I would do is I started running, and I would reward myself with a Newport cigarette at the end of my runs when I first started. And it was like, whew, it was really, really powerful. So there was that. So then all these years later, I'm running and I'm seeing these like crumpled up, you know, you see trash and a frequent trash item I see on my run is a crinkled pack of Newport, of smoked Newports, which is the wrapper. And during a run, about a year ago or so, that song came to me while I was running. Like, I want to be your pack of Newports. Just and then just playing with that as my metaphor, just knowing how the whole sense of like the dire the desperation and the sense of, you know, dire addiction really gave the song, you know, from my personal experience, that and a blues format was the perfect place to put it. I wanna be, and I really wrote most of that melody on my run, came back and figured it out on the guitar.
I was very impressed with that song in particular. I remember listening to it, and when it was over, I just said, wow, what a perfect blues song. I can just hear Irma Thomas singing that.
Cool. Wow, wouldn't that be something?
I wanna be your pack of Newport, living in your pocket, close to your heart. I wanna be your bag of Newport, above your wallet, that's living smart. You can light me up after breakfast, you can light me up after lunch, you can light lighter out of beauty.
someday.
About the song Don't Make Me Wrong.
Don't make me. I think once you're in a relationship or trying to start a relationship, you always second, third, and, you know, millionth guess it. And, you know, yourself, just because of the ups and downs and the difficulties that, you know, when you try to take a romantic love and build a lifestyle around that and, a partnership around that, it's complicated and it's difficult. And it's like you think, what the heck am I doing sometimes?
I wanna give my heart away. I think about you every day. This love's more than I can take. Of everything, the wedding bells, the diamond ring, this kind of love you can't fake. Don't make me wrong for loving you. I have paid and triple the price, and I have tried time after time to be kind, but now I know I just have to let you go. It wouldn't be right to hold on to a lie. I wanna give my heart away. I think about you every day. This love's more than I can take. Don't wanna give up everything. The wedding bells, the diamond ring. This kind of love you can't fake. Tall as an air, sitting high in the sky. Not see me, though I was waving back at you. Little did I know you always had other plans. Now I understand. You walk right by and hardly remember my name. That hurts too much. To be on fire and burned by your flame. You did not notice my pain when I dressed in
best dress right then, right there. I knew I failed the love test. Don't make me wrong for loving you.
Please talk about the song You Got Me.
That's really kind of a song that reaches out in terms of reassurance that, you know, I'm going to be there for you, like, no matter what. That's what that's about. You know, it's funny to talk about these songs because they're really pretty in-your-face, kind of. I didn't really encase these songs or cloak them, whatever, in some sort of mysterious metaphor. I am guilty of that in some songs somewhere. I think these are pretty straightforward, and they're really real.
Oh, the blues are not really subtle.
No, no, you're absolutely right.
That's the new album.
Yeah.
Let's go back to some history. Tell me about your first band.
Wow. Well, the first trio I was in was actually in the third grade with a couple of friends, Sabrina Nass and Terry Rosen. We did Young Girl. Why, I don't know. I love the song, but I think we did it really badly. And at a talent contest. And I think we came in second, so that didn't go so well. Then I had a band, I think what would be considered my first real band was a band called Sonia and the Night Band. And it was also a trio, but this time it had bass and drums. And we did play some in Baltimore and in D.C., but pretty short-lived. I just remember rehearsing in the building that became, that was the 930 Club, and schlepping our stuff up these steps when the elevator didn't work, and it was no air conditioning in the hot summers in the 80s. It was tough. And then there was a band I had called Exhibit A that was a trio and then a quartet. And then my sister came to join that band. Actually, you know what? I'm skipping a band. There was a band called Girl Friday right before Exhibit A. Exhibit A kind of broke off from Girl Friday. Anyway, when Cindy came to join my band, Exhibit A, and I think she just sort of like blew everything out of the water, so the band broke up, and Cindy, that was the birth of Disappear Fear, because Cindy and I were really serious about doing music and doing it full time everywhere we could, and recording, and, you know, the whole deal. So we did, and that was the beginning of Disappear Fear.
Was Cindy in Girl Friday?
No. Cindy was in Exhibit A for a short amount of time before the band imploded.
Okay, so she wasn't in that cool video of Back to Back.
No, she wasn't in that. No, she wasn't.
I asked Sonia about the video of Girl Friday doing Back to Back because it's included on Sonia's DVD called Happy Birthday, Sonia, as a bonus video, a rare treat from her history from 1984. Now remember, this was a fairly early recording, so don't be too hard on the sound quality. But I still wanted to share with you a little bit of it. What was the genesis of the name Disappear Fear?
I was working at the Baltimore Center for Victims of Sexual Assault, and they were looking for a new name for the center, something a little bit snappier. So I came up with the Disappear Fear Center because when someone is assaulted and abused, really they become, a person becomes very, very scared of their world, and I thought that a way to kind of get their lives back, get their confidence and empowerment back, would be to disappear fear. So that's what I came up with, and I presented that name to the board, and they rejected it. And so I had written it on this little yellow post-it on my desk, and I would see it. And at the time was the time that my sister had come to join Exhibit A, and it didn't work. And so I just thought, wow, disappear fear. Like, the more I thought about it, the more it seemed like a really cool name for a band. And Cindy and I were just starting singing together, and other than calling ourselves the Rutstein Sisters, we became Disappear Fear.
Okay, this would be a good time to mention that on your albums, your solo albums, you spell your name with all caps but a small I.
Yeah. I do that because it's just really sort of a checkpoint that we're all really just a small I, and kind of a reminder of keeping things in check as far as perspective and ego and judgment goes. Also, I like the shape of it. I like the way it looks. And when I put that down as a small I and raise the other ones up, it sort of gives it its own sort of sense of logo, regardless of wherever it is. It sort of makes it pop visually a little bit.
I've also seen on your site that your different names have been kind of a marketing disaster. It's Disappear Fear, it's Sonia, it's Sonia of Disappear Fear, it's Sonia and Disappear Fear.
Yes, that's true. Like, if you want me on iTunes and you want a particular album, let's say you want Almost Chocolate, and you look up Disappear Fear, you won't find it under that, and you have to put in Sonia of Disappear Fear in order to get that particular CD. And the thing that's also frustrating about that, like on iTunes and I think Amazon as well, which are the two big ones, is that it doesn't cross-reference me. Like, for instance, it'll say, oh, Sonia sounds like Tracy Chapman or someone, and it won't say Sonia sounds like Disappear Fear. Well, you know, you'd think it would, because it's all the same person. Disappear Fear, Sonia, Sonia of Disappear Fear, and Sonia and Disappear Fear are completely synonymous, because it's all me on my songs. but yeah, it is. You have to do a little bit of work there.
Okay, looking at all the Disappear Fear and Sonia albums, I'm curious, which one has been the best-selling one?
That's a good question. I think it was Disappear Fear self-titled, but then I think moving into second place, then I think Me Too outsold that, and then No Bomb Is Smart outsold that. So I think No Bomb Is Smart at this point is the biggest.
Under just the name Disappear Fear, there were five CDs between the years 1988 and 1996, and I'll definitely volunteer that it was difficult choosing what songs to ask about, as I love so many of them. but I kind of settle roughly on one song per album, starting with the first album, Echo My Call, and the song From Baltimore to Anywhere.
Baltimore to Anywhere. Wow. I wrote that in the living room of my one-bedroom apartment that I was sharing with my partner at the time. And it was very, very real. I was in the living room, and she was in the kitchen, and I was just sort of reflecting on the moment. It's a slow, sad song, but it's really more about hope and, you know, the next phase of things.
Scribble dates and round trip tickets to United Air Flight 79 from Baltimore to anywhere. I see LA in a pink Rolls Royce, a turquoise pool, and a real deep voice from Baltimore.
I'm going to slip in sort of a hit parade extra, a song Sonia sent me a few years ago. This is one of their very earliest recordings and one they contributed to a benefit cassette for the homeless in Baltimore, so it would be almost impossible to find, making it all the more appealing for me to share it with you. So we're having a Christmas in July moment with a little of their song, Christmas Makes Me Realize.
It's a song that I had written. I probably actually wrote it probably in 1984, 1985. I really wrote it about, I was home by myself one Christmas, and my girlfriend was at home far away with her parents, and I was really, really missing her. That's where when I sat down and wrote that song. And so the line is, Christmas makes me realize how much I love you. So it was just a romantic moment. And Cindy and I sang it, and I played the guitar in the early days of Disappear Fear. That was the form. And that's really how the song happened. We were asked to donate a song to a compilation CD that was coming out for Christmas. And I think a lot of people were mostly just doing covers, but I had written this song, and I had always wanted to record it, so that was my opportunity. And we did that. Sonia of Disappear Fear, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, there's a part two of this show with much more of the music of Sonia. That's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. The second album by Disappear Fear was called Deep Soul Diver, and it contains one of their most popular songs, Sexual Telepathy.
Ooh. I guess I was nervous. That's always a thing, I think, in relationships where you're, or maybe in my relationships where you're just scared, okay, my partner's gonna love someone or fall in love with someone, you know, who's more sexy than me, or, you know, who's got something better than me, and I'm kind of worried about it. So it always comes back to, you know, be true now. I know that we have something here, but I'm sort of worried about losing it.
One song that I don't think gets enough attention that I've always loved is from your Live at the Bottom Line album. It's Box of Tissues.
Oh, that was an early favorite of a lot of Disappear Fear fans. That was a must do at concerts, and I still get lots of requests for it. And in fact, when I was in Holland a little while ago, I did an impromptu concert, and the audience was singing the background vocals that Cindy used to sing on it, which is nice. I love it when the audience does that. In fact, it was that song that we sang in the offices of Freddie Beanstalk Publishing in London. You know, I took out my guitar, and the people were standing around the room, and the head of the company at the time said, after we did that song, sign them up. So that song was the song that really clinched our first publishing deal. So there you are. You got a good head for these things.
Well, I remember when you played. I've seen you many times, but I remember we were at the Mucky Duck in Houston, and I requested that song, and you did it.
Oh wow! Yeah, I love it. I love that song.
I put a box of
From the 1994 Disappear Fear album, just called Disappear Fear, talk about the song Moment of Glory, please.
That song, I wrote most of it, I was starting to really tour a whole lot. And I think what I was talking about in it is basically like, I knew a lot of other, no, I didn't know a lot. I knew some other famous artists that were lesbians, that were very much in the closet, enjoying a great deal of commercial success. And I was sort of reflecting on my own situation, you know, and like, I couldn't do it that way. You know, I have to be who I am.
Nobody's gonna tell me. Nobody's gonna tell me what to feel. Me and Lee, a bottle of motorcycle. Got my guitar and I turn outside. My lover, she used to be my rival. And I don't want my money back. But I know.
That album has some very respectable help on it, like the Indigo Girls and Janice Ian.
Yes, yes, they came in to sing on it. Amy and Emily actually are on 3 of the 11 tracks on that CD. Yeah, and Janice does the guitar solo and also singing on Who's So Scared. She really loved that song. That was cool.
That's the next one I want to ask about. Talk about Who's So Scared.
Who's So Scared started as a poem by County Cullen. I took County's poem and I wrote this melody underneath it, and I went just naturally into that chorus, like, of Who's So Scared, like how that was such a stopping thing, like the question that seems to really inspire me to do something sometimes is, what would I do if I wasn't scared? You know, like, what would I do? And do that thing. So that's really the essence of that song. And then just bringing in the idea of not just racism, but homophobia, and bringing all that together. And then we had actually gone ahead and recorded it, and then the record label, that was on Rounder Records, had to get permission from the County Cullen estate to use that poem, and fortunately they said yes, and everything was fine.
Once, riding in a Baltimore heart filled, head filled with grief, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. And I was 8 and very small, and he was no whip digger. And so I smiled, but he pulled out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May to December, of all the things that happened there. That's all that I remember. Ooh. Bye.
from Seed in the Sahara, I'd like to hear about BYOG.
BYOG. BYOG, bring your own God. I was just, again, I was traveling. We toured so much, and I remember when I came up with that idea, BYOG, bring your own God, and I just thought it's so applicable because we do bring our own God everywhere we are, whether that's the, you know, whether that's your position of that there isn't a God, being atheist or being agnostic or not, or whatever it is that you call your God. My idea with the song is really to take it from a personal place to the place of, it sort of goes in a backwards motion of a more general idea to a more specific idea, then to a very personal idea on the verses of the song.
I saw a man with no one to talk to. I saw my grandmother with no one to walk with. I saw my brother walking away. I saw my sister ask him to stay. Trying hard to remember what music means. Has he let fear corrupt his
think your being open about being gay has affected your career?
You know, I am, I get asked that really a lot, and I never know how to answer it. I honestly don't know. For me, there would have been, JD, no other option. I have to use the palette that I use. I think it's unfortunate that a lot of people probably aren't going to get to hear my music because that's an issue for them. Hopefully, as time goes on, more people will get to hear it.
This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Music Heritage, and I want to thank you all for listening, and Sonia for the wonderful interview. Remember, you can hear more of the interview and listen to her talk about her recordings since 1998 at my website at queermusicheritage.com. Closing this part, I thought it appropriate to go back for one more song from the new release, Blood, Bones, in Baltimore, and ask her about the song, Call Me Sonia.
Call Me Sonia. That was, well, what was happening was this, is because this is a new genre for me, I thought maybe it'd be cool to do some more covers by some other blues artists, because God knows there's some great ones. And I asked some of my friends who I know are really into those genres, you know, if they had any samples of stuff that they thought I should hear. So they gave me, you know, hundreds of songs. And I was listening to their stories a lot. And finally, I was just thinking, you know, these are really personal stories. You know, everyone's got sort of a sad story. And it seemed sort of silly for me to be singing someone else's story. Not that I couldn't, but, you know, that I had a story as well. So one afternoon when I was listening to all this stuff, I just pulled out my guitar and I was just like, okay, this is my story in this moment. And I liked the way it sounded. It was either really going to be Sink or Swim. I think some people will really like that song and some people will be like kind of, what is that? You know?
Call me Sonia cause I play the pinkest blues. Stoned or sober, and it's all because of you. Sometimes she makes me so mad. Busted a soda can in her kitchen. Now I'm sticking to the floor. And that's the reason I am bitching. Call me crazy cause I play the pinkest blues. I'm sorry if I disappointed you. She'd like to toss me out the door. Since I'm the one shaking up the coke can. It exploded after a 9-hour lumpy, bumpy ride in the van. Oh, and did you like the show tonight? Will you be coming back for more? Buy every CD I ever made. Wear my t-shirts cutting up your wedding cake. Stick my bumper stickers on the back of your car. You took me a groovy, hokey pokey cause I play the pinkest blues. It's purple. Stoned or sober, and it's all because of you.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links